We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the program a talented comedy writer. He was a member of the original writing staff at Saturday Night Live. He teamed up to co-create its Gary Shandling show, worked with Billy Crystal on his smash Broadway show, 700 Sundays, won the Thurber Prize for his novel, The Other Shulman, and collaborated with Dave Barry on the book Lunatics. He's got a brand new book of his own chronicling his years as a comedy writer. It's called Laugh Lines, 40 Years Trying to Make Funny People Funnier. We caught up with Alan Zweibel earlier this afternoon, and before we went on the air, we were discussing headphones and the fact that I was wearing them and Alan didn't have any, and that led us into me suggesting what would make the best a headwear for our conversation today. I would like it if you were wearing a bowler hat. Is that possible, Alan?
You know something? That's a silly question because that's what I wear during pandemics anyway. So I put it on this morning.
I think that's the hat of choice in a pandemic. Well, it's wonderful to have you back on with us. Loved your book so much. I knew I would laugh. What I didn't expect is to tear up reading the foreword when you talked about going back to SNL for the 40th reunion and thinking about all of those who weren't there for that.
Well, you know, it was a very emotional time, and you're quite right. It swung both ways. It was a joyous celebration. It was 40 years, my God. And, you know, I went with my wife. I met my wife on the show, and it was a celebration of this new show that started in 1975. And I looked around and I go, wow, look at all the people who were here, from the Mick Jaggers to my pal Larry David. And it's just, you know, every which way in every year, athletes and whatever. So it was a great, great celebration. On the other hand, as I say in the book, you know, it's like going to your old neighborhood and you expect to see the same people living in the same houses as you were when you lived there. So when I walked into the studio, my last reference, and I had been to that studio a number of times since, but on an evening like this, you know, there were apparitions. There was Belushi, there was Gilda, there was a mentor of mine named Herb Sargent and Michael O'Donoghue. So it was a lot of memories that took place there. I was there for 5 years. And it was such a impactful time in all of our lives. It was very emotional, you know. Plus, we were still alive, you know. it's just like a high school reunion. Who's here? Who's happy with their lives? Who's who's feeling good about things since then? And the nostalgia was just, you can imagine, it was just dripping with it.
One of the many people that you worked with and I know was a hero of yours. He's always been a comedy hero of mine and has passed away since the last time we talked with you. Can you talk a little bit about what Buck Henry meant to you in your career and as a friend?
You know, both aspects of Buck were monumental for me. I grew up, you know, on Long Island. My dad worked in New York City. And when I would come in and run errands for him, no matter where the errand was, I'd make sure it went by 30 Rock, you know. And because at the time, this was in the mid-60s, you know, Johnny Carson had the Tonight Show upstairs. And there was a show called That Was the Week That Was that starred David Frost. And one of the guys in the show was Buck Henry. And watching that show, I took an immediate liking to him, and then I saw him in The Graduate, and I realized that he wrote The Graduate, and I was a huge fan of Get Smart, and he had co-created Get Smart with Mel Brooks. And so when in college, I used to watch Buck go on The Tonight Show and just talk to Johnny Carson for 8 minutes about nothing, absolutely nothing that would make me laugh. So when he came to do the show, I was in awe. I must say I was a little nervous. I figured here was a guy that, he was Buck Henry. You know, he was godlike when it came to somebody who was witty and somebody who was a writer and was such an influence on the culture. So when I became friends with him, and we became very close friends, you know, the entree was I used to write these samurai sketches for John Belushi, and Buck was in most of them. he was a perfect stooge for John Samurai character. So because I wrote them and we rehearsed it together, we started becoming friendly, and then we went out for lunches and dinners and became terrific, terrific friends through the years. And what I got from Buck, more than anything, was longevity. What I got from him was, because here's a guy who, you know, we tend to look at somebody, our heroes especially, and look at them as like they were always on top. And I saw him through some failures that he had, some foul tips. And he just kept his head down, and he was a writer. And up until his death, at the age of 89, he was still writing. And he taught me, not by telling me, but by example, that we do what we do, and we just keep doing it. And, yeah, some things people will embrace, some things people, for whatever reason, will turn their backs on. But this is the business we've chosen. This is the way that we were born, and just keep going. So I got to tell you that he was a monster, monster loss when we got the word.
A big smile came to my face when you were recounting your childhood and an album that your parents used to play that I used to hear in my house all the time growing up, an album called You Don't Have to Be Jewish.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'm thrilled because so many people don't remember that anymore. My parents played comedy albums, and that was one of them. It was also Alan Sherman's record. Mm. And when Kennedy was president, he was the first family. But You Don't Have to Be Jewish was, it had this cast. You have Lou Jacoby and Olin Polanka,
yes,
and people that nobody's heard of since. Okay, really. And it was little sketches and and little scenes, audible scenes that took place between these cast members. And it was, I remember my parents laughing, and I didn't like what they listened to. The comedy albums were different, and this was older school, but it sure made me laugh a lot.
Well, it was good preparation for your first professional work, writing lines for comedians in the Catskills, as you call it in the book, writing for the Willie Lomans of stand-up comedy.
Well, you know, and the reason I dubbed it as that is that these guys didn't have television shows. They didn't have something that they strove to have that. Their hopes were that they would play in these nightclubs in the Catskill hotels. And in the heyday of the Catskills, the 50s and the 60s, you know, the people like Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, and Red Buttons, and Alan King, and Tony Fields, that was a breeding ground. And it was a jumping off point to huge careers that they got on the West Coast. They got their own TV series. And these guys, by the time I got there, the Catskills were dying. The hotels were starting to close one by one. And these were the guys that were left behind. And I called them the Willie Lomans because they got in their car, and just like Willie Loman would drive up to Boston or wherever to sell, they would go from their homes and drive up to the different hotels. They would sell their jokes. Okay? They were like the workers. You know, they weren't the executives, you know, and then they get back in the car after the show, and, you know, they probably got their paycheck, and they drove home. And there was something about the itinerant nature of not having, once again, a studio to go to, you know what I mean, where they had a TV show. It was the also-ran, you know, they were Willie Loman. They went, they had their jokes, and they went up and sold their wares.
And who knew that you could even get paid by the pound for writing jokes?
Well, you know, that was such a weird expression. When I started, this was in the 72, the going rate up there was $7 a joke. And then it started to, you know, if the word go around about you, you could say, okay, I want $10, I want $12, you know, it went like that. But then the next thing was, if you wrote routines, they paid you per minute. That meant the delivered minute. Okay, so usually a page of jokes is what would take a minute to tell. So there was four or five jokes on the page. And that was all about one subject. But I learned a phrase which people seem to be intrigued by is a pound of jokes, which was basically a handful of jokes about anything you thought was funny. And I had once asked, well, how much is in a pound? And, you know, I said, well, 16. And I go, well, gee, you know, that means that each pound is an ounce. And you know, if you multiply each joke by $7, which I ordinarily get, for $100 for a pound, I'm losing money that way. So we would bargain how much was a pound.
We're talking with Alan Zweibel. His new book is called Laugh Lines, 40 Years Trying to Make Funny People Funnier. And you wrote for those Catskill comics, but is it safe to say that you wanted to write for your own generation and not your parents' generation?
Well, what had happened was, you know, these guys were older than me, and I was the same age as their children. And so I was the same age as their kids who were rebelling against the establishment that they were talking about. So, you know, it was the age of Woodstock and Vietnam and Watergate. So what I didn't want to write for my parents. That wasn't my sweet spot. I lived in a different place mentally. So I took all the jokes those guys wouldn't buy for me. And there were two clubs in New York City at the time. One was called The Improvisation. The other was called Catch a Rising Star. And I took the jokes that those old guys wouldn't buy for me. I got on stage. And my plan was to deliver those jokes and with the hopes that somebody would like the material. I didn't want to be a comic. It was my way of advertising how I wrote. And ultimately, Lorne Michaels liked the material and gave me a job on a new show that he was putting together called Saturday Night Live that was going to premiere the following fall.
How would you describe yourself in that brief time as a stand-up comedian?
Awful. Just awful. If people liked the joke, they laughed, and I felt fine. But I couldn't perform, you know. So if somebody heckled me or if a joke fell flat, it was just, I didn't know what to do. I just started sweating.
Last time you were on with us, you told us about that first meeting, the first writer's meeting with Gilda Radner hiding behind the potted plant there. You went on to have such a great working and personal relationship with Gilda through the years. And I thought it was very interesting in the book. You talked about, a specific way that Gilda would help you with nerves when you had to appear in sketches.
Well, she was, what she would do, because it was live TV, and I've since gotten over it, thank God. I go on a lot of talk shows and I do speaking engagements, but in those days, I was so nervous. I was afraid if I go on live TV that, you know, I would either faint or I would just lose my words entirely and forget how to talk, or I would have no control out of my mouth, like sort of like a Tourette's thing. And I was just so frightened that what Gilda would do is give me a shot of whiskey or vodka or a little bit too much wine just to calm my nerves.
I was interested to read about the process that you two went through, and it was a grueling process creating and refining the Roseanne Adana sketches.
Well, we were married to that character. We put all our energy into whatever we wrote, and it was a great degree of sublimation, at least it was for me. And so what we would do is go back and forth. I would write a draft, and I would submit it to her the day of the show, and she would take out a red pencil like a school mom and start marking it up. And then you know, I'd be pissed off because I was up all night, you know, writing. And here she is, you know, she's passing judgment and making, like, corrections. And as I left the dressing room and would go up to my office, I'd look at what she wrote and I'd go, oh, God, she's right. This is better than what I had. And then I would go, well, I'll show her, and I would try to top her. And it would go back and forth all day that by the time we got it on the air, you know, it was, for the most part, really humming. But we weren't talking to each other. It was just, you know, it was like the worst of a bad marriage. You know what I mean? And it was what I would imagine. And but creatively, it was we had some success.
the makeup process after the, for lack of a better term, fights over these, over the sketches, were sometimes lengthy. And there's a great story about how Woody Allen helped solve one of the fights.
Well, what had happened was, you know, like any couple, you know, the fight is over if one can make the other one laugh. And there was a brunch we attended, and the Gilda wanted to make up, and I just felt like being, you know, in an argument that much longer, I needed to be mad longer than she needed to be mad. And so when we were in a somebody's apartment and there was a brunch, and she tried to get my attention to make me laugh, make funny faces, do stuff, and I kept turning away. I didn't want to give her the satisfaction of me laughing, and I wanted to stay mad. And at one point, Woody Allen happened to come by, and he had a couple of plates filled with brunch stuff, you know, bagels and, you know, lox and two cups of coffee. And Gilda knew that he was my idol. And so I sort of saw out of the corner of my eye, she stopped him. She put a hand on each of his shoulders, and he didn't know who she was. And she said, "I'm sorry, but I got to make Lydell laugh." So there was a step down into a living room. She sort of pushed him down the step, and all the food went flying all over the place. And I started laughing, and that was the end of our fight.
You also write about the most infamous guest hosting appearance ever on SNL, Milton Berle on there. And, well, you got to see the real legend of Milton Berle up close and personal.
Well, his legend preceded him, and he... I had written before I got to SNL, I wrote for a lot of the Friars Club roast. And he was generally the roast master. And, you know, those were all SAG luncheons at that time. And because the club wasn't, you know, co-ed. This was in the, you know, earlier days. This was in the 70s when I started going there. It wasn't until the late 80s that they admitted women. So it was a big boys club, and they would have a roast that would have 2,000 people in the ballroom of a huge hotel. And Milton, you know, I never wrote for him, but I would write about him, you know, for whoever was, you know, who's ever part of the roast that I was writing for. You know, and the thing you do with any of those things is you write towards the person's stereotype, and you make fun of it. And there's two stereotypes that Milton Berle had. Was one, that he stole other people's jokes. But two is that he had the, well, let's just say the longest differential, okay? He was like a walking tripod. And when he came to host the show, I was in his dressing room, and he was wearing a short bathrobe that came sort of like mid-thigh. And I said to him, you know, I said, "Boy, it's really interesting that I'm meeting you, because for so many years I wrote about your penis. And, you know, here I am, I'm meeting you." And, you know, I used to write these jokes like, you know, it was so big that after his circumcision, they used the foreskin to cover the infield at Yankee Stadium. You know, those kind of jokes. And he said, "Oh, you've never seen it." I go, "Yeah, I was tongue-tied." He goes, "Would you like to?" And I was somewhere between the N and the O in no, when he, you know, he just opened his robe, and yeah, he took out an anaconda. It was, you know, yeah. So I thought, and he was notorious for that. He would take it out and show it to anybody, whether they wanted to see it or not. That's what he would do.
Alan Zweibel with us here on Downtown. You mentioned you met your wife, Robin, on the show. One of my favorite stories in the book is the time that both of your mothers were cast as extras in a sketch.
Well, our parents hadn't met yet, and Robin was a production assistant, and her job, among the many duties of a production assistant, was to fill a room, you know, on a sketch, you know, with extras. And there was a bar mitzvah sketch. Kirk Douglas was the host, and he played the bar mitzvah boy's grandfather. So there was a dais that had, you know, Belushi and Bill Murray and Gilda and Kirk Douglas, you know, like I said, as the grandfather. And so Robin thought it was a good idea that maybe our mothers could meet. So she cast them both to be extras in it. And Robin had no way of knowing that my mother would get really upset that Robin's mother had a better table at the bar mitzvah. Yeah. So, a little pat-fighting ensued.
You eventually left Saturday Night Live and moved on and eventually would team up with Gary Shandling to create one of the most influential shows in television. It's Gary Shandling's Show. When did you realize the level of chemistry that you two had together?
Pretty immediately. We had dinner. We made each other laugh. And for me, it was like lightning striking a second time. He was like Gilda. You know, and I told him what my relationship with Gilda was like. You know, with Gilda, the chemistry was in such where he sort of brought out the woman in me, and I brought out the guy in her. And I told that to Gary, and we just took turns, you know, being the woman the 4 years that we worked together.
He was not an easy person to work with, though.
Gary was a perfectionist. Gary didn't have a wife and children like I did, and like most of the writers did. So his work was his life. And because of that, he didn't think twice of calling you at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to discuss a joke. He didn't think twice of when I would give him an edited show for him to call me in the wee hours on a Sunday morning and say, gee, why is that a two-shot? Why isn't it a single of me? And I go, geez, Gary, just could have waited until 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. But this was, he was so focused. And from everything that I knew about Gary when he did Larry Sanders' show, it was very much the same thing. It was a double-edged sword because Gary was a genius. Gary was a great writer, and there are so many writers, including Judd Apatow, who learned from Gary. I learned from Gary. So there was something about him that you were attracted to. You felt that you were in the company of really a brilliant, you know. But at the same time, as flattered as you were that he liked you and wanted to work with you, it then became demanding in a way that was very difficult, very, very difficult to withstand.
Working on that show also gave you the opportunity to provide Gilda with her last television appearance. What was that experience like?
Well, what happened was, when I moved out to L.A. to do its Gary Shandling show, and I moved Robin, and we only had two children. We eventually had a third, who was Gilda's, Gilda's her godmother. Gilda informed me that she had ovarian cancer. And she said, I asked her, how can I help? What do I do? I was just, beside myself with this news. And she said, make me laugh. That was my role when my buddy got sick. And at one point, she wanted to come on its Gary Shandling show. Gary and I would do a show every week. We would send her a cassette, like it was a Hallmark card. I would talk to her, tell her jokes on the phone. That's what we did. That was my role. And when we went for a walk on the beach one night, and she was talking about the possibility of doing the Shandling show, and she got cold feet. She hadn't been on TV in 6-7 years, something like that. And she was afraid that the studio audience, when she came on stage, wouldn't even remember her. And then I was just about starting to say, don't be silly, when she says, I've got to do the show. My comedy is the only weapon I have against this thing. And then she said, can you help me make cancer funny? And she came on the show. And she came through the door unsuspected. The audience didn't suspect it. We didn't announce it. She was a surprise guest. And the audience, God, this was an audience she didn't think would remember her. They went berserk, She didn't look the same. She had shorter hair, and she was a little frail. And they really embraced her. And she was nominated for an Emmy for that appearance. And we thought she was in remission. And we started talking about creating a show for her, Gary Shandling and myself, creating a show for Gilda for HBO. And then the disease caught up with her, and she ultimately passed. But that was her last television performance, yeah.
And even after she passed, as you point out in the book, she bailed you out of a little bit of a rut when you created Bunny Bunny.
Yeah, you know something? I had had, after Gilda died, I had had a couple of, I had a movie that did awful, and I had a TV series that got canceled. And Robin, my wife, said, you know, you should write something about you and Gilda. And I resisted. I didn't want to capitalize on a friendship. And she said, the hell with that. Your best friend died. You haven't even cried yet. This is like 3-4 years after she passed. So as a way of dealing with her death, what I did was I went back in my mind and I recreated the whole relationship as I remembered it. Where did we meet? Oh, it was behind that tree in Lauren's office. And I went through the events of the 14 years that we were these platonic lovers, if you will, and it ended, 225 handwritten pages later with a eulogy I gave at her memorial. And I figured, okay, catharsis is over, and I had no intention of getting it published. I showed it to some friends, including Gary Shandling and Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, and ultimately Gene Wilder, who was killed his husband, just as a nostalgic thing. You know, they knew me, they know me and Gilda, and they all urged me to get it published. So ultimately I did. And the book was a big seller. And because it was written in dialogue, it was easy to perform. Mm. He talks, I talk, he talks, you know, she talks, I talk, she talks, I talk. I wrote it that way because I wanted the intimacy to be the words touching each other again. I didn't want the formality of grammar and semicolons and punctuation, you know. I just wanted the words, you know, to touch each other again. So because it was written that way, it lent itself to be delivered, spoken. So Gilda's Club was being founded around that time, and James L. Brooks, the great writer, director, who won Oscars for Terms of Endearment and the Broadcast News and created Mary Tyler Moore and a little thing called The Simpsons, he staged some readings that were fundraisers for this new thing called Gilda's Club. And we did one in L.A. and we did one here in New York. Both of them were Jason Alexander read Alan, me, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus read Gilda's part. And it helped found or raise money initially for Gilda's Club, but a byproduct of it was, I'd done something that was successful again. And it was a lesson that if you write something that you love and you do it from your heart, there'll be an honesty to it that people will be attracted to.
You mentioned the TV series, and well, it's hard to believe you couldn't make those cut-ups, Ryan O'Neal and Farrah Fawcett, funny.
No. That laugh duo. And I had, they were surrounded by a cast of supporting actors that had maybe 4 or 5 Tony Awards among them. And the writer's room had about a dozen Emmy Awards. And nobody could figure it out. We just couldn't figure out how to do it. And the show was mercifully canceled. I think we did 13 episodes. And, that's what one would call a foul tip.
You had a big success when you collaborated with your longtime friend, Billy Crystal, on his wonderful show, 700 Sundays. Did that really, in many ways, bring your relationship full circle?
Well, it did, in the sense that when we started out, we were friends when we were both starting out in 1974. And I lived with my parents after college in Woodmere, Long Island. He lived about four towns over in Long Beach, Long Island. He was already married. They had a daughter. And he would pick me up every night in his Volkswagen. We'd drive it to the city. We would do our respective, you know, acts on stage. And then he'd drive me home. We would listen to the cassettes in the car and critique each other, how we did, which joke worked, which didn't. Maybe you say it this way. Maybe you say it that way. And then, you know, I got SNL, and he left New York. He went out to do soap. And we reunited when I moved out to L.A. I shared a suite. Rob Reiner's company was called Castle Rock. And in one of the suites there, you know, and Rob, first of all, he hosted the third Saturday Night Live ever. And we always liked each other. So that was a great thing. And he came up as a guest on his Gary Shandling show. So it was really great. But I shared a suite with Larry David and Billy Crystal. The three of us started out like the same day back in the 70s, you know. And so we always were very appreciative of the irony of the whole thing. And how fortunate is this? What are the odds? And Billy and I had not worked with each other. And I was working on a movie script with Jesse Nelson, this wonderfully talented writer. She wrote a movie called Corinna, Corinna, that she wrote, directed. And since then, she wrote the book for Waitress, the Broadway play,
right,
the musical. And she and I were working on a script, and Billy stuck his head in the office, and he asked me to come in. I followed him into his office, and he said he was thinking of doing a one-man Broadway show called 700 Sundays about his family. It got its title because, you know, Billy's dad worked 2-3 jobs, worked 6 days a week to support the family. And Sundays was their day, you know, to go to a ball game, you know, go on the boardwalk or bowling, whatever. And Billy's dad died suddenly when Billy was 15. So he calculated that he had roughly 700 Sundays with him. So hence the title. And Billy asked me if I would collaborate with him. On it with him. And I said, my God, yes. And we did it. And it became, you know, I was just honored that somebody would trust me with their life, would trust me with the characters that he was paying tribute to, allowed me to put words in their mouths. I never met these people. You know, I met his brothers. I know his brothers to this day, but I didn't know his parents. I didn't know his aunts and uncles and extended family. But, you know, I'm a Jew from Long Island. He's a Jew from Long Island. It's not like we were from foreign, you know, planets, you know. It was reminiscent of my own family. And we had a lot of fun and a great, a big, big success with it. And to this day, I would say it's definitely one of the highlights. It's not the highlight. And most recently, Billy and I collaborated on another thing. We wrote a script together, a movie that he directed and that he stars in with Tiffany Haddish. It's called Here Today, and it's been edited. And I think they still have to do a little post-production on the music. But, you know, whenever movie theaters open again, it will be released, you know. And we were both very, very well aware once again of what our roots were, how we started out together, and so many years later collaborating and doing this together again. You know, it was very, very touching for the two of us and very, very significant on a lot of levels.
You also ended up collaborating with Martin Short, and that also brought to fruition a friendship that Gilda wanted to see happen for many years.
I had never heard of Marty Short when we started SNL. You know, he wasn't on SCTV. I didn't know who it was. They lived together in Toronto when they were both up in Second City, and she had told me about this guy, and I took her word, but she spoke about him in such hyperbolic terms, like the funniest person on the planet, this and that. And we were doing a show with Belushi and Aykroyd and Lorraine Newman. You know, what do you mean? What are you saying? And then many things so good. He sang, he danced, his body moved in such a funny way that bodies don't usually go, you know. He can impersonate a really sharp, quick wit. And she said, I want you guys to be friends. And years later, when we were living in L.A., I knew him socially, and we liked each other, but he was having a show that was Broadway bound. It was out of town in San Francisco. We had the same manager who called me up after I came over from the book tour and said, listen, they're having a little trouble with the show. They flew me out to San Francisco. I saw it. I thought I could be of help. And, you know, it was San Francisco, then Toronto, Chicago, and then Broadway. And it was a lot of fun. I see the show, then I go back to my hotel room. I write some jokes, call Marty in his hotel room, and we'd be writing jokes until 2, 3 in the morning and put it into the show the next night. And it just kept on, it flourished, you know. So to this day, he's a good pal, and he and I are working on something together as we speak. That's how much we like working with each other. It was sort of deigned by Gilda.
You worked with Dave Barry on the wonderful book Lunatics, but what I didn't know until reading your book was that you also got involved with the Rock Bottom Remainders. Our station is owned by Stephen King.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, Dave Barry and I met when Steve Martin was given the Mark Twain Award, which is like the Comedy Lifetime Achievement Award. And there was a big, big ceremony at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and Dave was a presenter. He gave a speech, you know. And Steve told him, you know, that he'd like Dave to give a speech about him. I was there that night because Larry David was also speaking, and I helped Larry with his speech. Dave and I met each other at the hotel afterwards, and we became friends. We saw each other many times. We ranked each other on our respective book tours, and then our wives met. They became friends, and I said to Dave, why don't we write something together? He was in Florida. I live in New Jersey. So we wrote a novel called Lunatics that was a big hit, and he and I alternated chapters. It was a feud between two neighbors, so he was the first. He took the person of one the neighbors, and I took the other one. And again, there was a book tour to promote that. And then at one point, he asked me, and I knew what the Rock Bottom Remainders were. And you know, and for those of you viewers, for those of you people who are looking at your radio right now, the Rock Bottom Remainders is a band comprised of best-selling authors, and so there's Dave Barry and Stephen King and Mitch Albom and Amy Tan, you know, and Scott Turow. And he said, would you like to be a remainder? And I said, well, gee, I can't sing and I don't play an instrument. He said, oh, you're going to fit in just fine. If anything, I was overqualified. So, yeah, I perform with them maybe about a dozen times now all over the country, and it's great fun. And finally met Stephen King, I guess it was about a year ago. We were in Minneapolis, and he was with he performed with us. And God, I really like this guy. You look at him, and you just see the first thing is you see thousands and thousands and thousands of pages that he churned out, you know. And I got to spend time with him and made him laugh. And he took a liking to my wife Robin, and found him very, very accessible. And it's really fun doing what I do because you get to meet and work with your hero.
Well, Alan, the book is absolutely wonderful. Laugh out loud, funny, and also makes you tear up more than one time along the way. Laugh Lines, 40 years trying to make funny people funnier. Get it? It's out officially today. You will love it. We also look forward to seeing here today once that's out. And thank you once again for coming on and talking with us this afternoon.
Appreciate you having me on. I'm thrilled you like the book, and I hope to speak to you again.